This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Michael and Carol Lubon? First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Michael and Carol Lubon met sometime around 1970 when they were attending North High School in Torrance, California. This coastal city is in southwest Los Angeles County. Michael was 16 years old at the time, and Carol was 15. They became romantically involved, and in 1971, they had a son named Michael Lubon Jr. After Carol finished high school in 1972, she and Michael married. About 2 years later, they had a daughter named Brandy. The family lived in a 700-square-foot two-bedroom house on Cranbrook Avenue in Torrance. Michael worked for a house painting business owned by Carol's father, Milton Meyer. Initially, Carol stayed home with the children, but eventually took a job with a tax preparation company because money was getting tight. Her plan wasn't to stay there forever. She studied architecture at El Camino College to support a career change someday. Michael and Carol argued from time to time. On two occasions, they separated temporarily. One topic the couple disagreed on was whether they should stay in their house. Carol was unhappy because it was too small and only had one bathroom. Michael thought it was just fine. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. On April 7, 1981, Michael reported Carol missing to the Torrance Police Department. He said that he last saw her on March 30, 1981 at 10 p.m. When he woke up at 4:45 a.m., now on March 31, Carol was nowhere to be found. On April 5, Carol's 1979 Audi Fox was found at the Red Onion restaurant in Redondo Beach. This prompted Michael to report Carol missing. Here's what the police found during the course of their investigation. Carol's vehicle was dusty, as if it had been parked at the restaurant for a few days, but did not yield any clues about where she was. On March 29, 2 days before Carol disappeared, Michael and Carol had dinner at the residence of Carol's parents. The couple was not getting along too well that night. When they left the residence, Carol told Michael to ride in the back seat of the car. Both Carol's mother, Melba, and Carol's sister, Gail, talked to Carol on the phone the next day, March 30. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. On March 31, Michael told family members that Carol was missing. When Michael was interviewed by the police on April 15, he mentioned a number of suspicious occurrences. For example, a piece of paper he placed on a dresser drawer to detect intrusion had been broken, like somebody had opened the drawer. One day when he returned home, he noticed some mail had been moved, and there had been about 15 telephone calls to the house where the caller disconnected after Michael answered. Michael was interviewed again on April 29. He told the police he thought Carol had been in their house because someone took money out of a secret hiding place, specifically under the butter dish in the refrigerator. Carol was the only other person who knew that money was there. Family members did not think Carol would ever abandon her family or leave without telling anyone. A wedding shower for Carol's sister, Terry, was scheduled for the same week that Carol disappeared. Carol was planning on attending the shower and was looking forward to assisting with planning the wedding. Carol's mother, Melba, felt as though Michael was being a little nonchalant about the disappearance, but he did seem to be sad. 10-year-old Michael Jr. told the police that his mother would not have left voluntarily, especially without saying goodbye. He didn't notice any strange behavior from his mother around the time of her disappearance. He described his father as being resistant to feelings of anger, but when his father lost his temper, he would explode like a powder keg. On the night his mother disappeared, Michael Jr. was listening to music through his headphones between 9 and 10:30 p.m. He was in bed during this time. The way his bed was positioned, he was able to see his mother, Carol, exit her bedroom, shut the door behind her, and walk down the hall. She was walking quickly and appeared to be upset. Michael Jr. heard the front door of the house slam. After Carol's disappearance, his father would become uncomfortable whenever her name came up and immediately change the subject. Carol's 7-year-old daughter, Brandy, told the police that her mother was great and had no reason to believe that she would ever abandon the family. On the night of Carol's disappearance, Brandy went to bed sometime between 8 and 9 p.m. From the bedroom she shared with her brother, she heard her parents talking about selling the house. Later, she heard a car start. Unlike her brother, who believed that their father dodged discussions about Carol, Brandy felt as though her father answered any questions that she had related to the disappearance. Neighbors said that Carol frequently complained about how small her house was. They also said Michael never talked about missing Carol. The police discovered that Carol was having an affair with one of her college classmates at the time of her disappearance. She admitted to her affair partner that she lived in the same house as her husband, but lied and said they were separated. Carol frequently visited bars and restaurants and may have been engaging in multiple affairs. Many people spoke well of Michael. Carol did not receive the same adulation. The police came to believe that no foul play was involved. Carol must have left on her own. In June 1981, the case was moved to inactive status. In 1987, the police reopened the investigation into Carol's disappearance after noticing that she was still missing. They thought by this time she would have shown up somewhere. There had been no activity indicating that Carol was alive. For example, there was no evidence that she had ever secured employment or paid taxes. The police spoke to Michael again. This time he added a few details to his original story. He claimed that Carol struck their son 2 days before she disappeared, although their son told the police that this never happened. Michael also said that after he and his wife argued on the night of March 30, 1981, they went to bed together. In his original story, Michael said he went to bed alone. Later, he heard Carol's car start and she drove away. According to Michael, 2 weeks after Carol disappeared, cash, photographs of the children, and some of Carol's clothing went missing from the house. Investigators really didn't see anything suspicious about the small changes to Michael's story, and the case once again went cold. By this point, Michael had moved on with his life. In February 1982, he started dating a woman named Carrie. They married in 1988 and went on to have 2 children. For some reason, Michael changed his last name to Clark, which had been his middle name. In 1997, Michael gave an interview to a local newspaper. He changed his story a little bit, saying that he heard the garage door go up on the morning Carol disappeared. In 2002, the police decided to take yet another look at Carol's disappearance. They noticed how Michael had made small changes in his story a few times, so they continued to investigate. They paid Michael a visit 8 years later in 2010, so they weren't exactly moving at light speed. Michael agreed to talk to the police without a lawyer and offered a new story about what happened. He said that on March 30, 1981, Carol tried to force him to sign a real estate contract to sell their house. She said to him, "You make my skin crawl." Michael last saw Carol when she was in the bathtub. At 1:30 a.m., now on March 31, he saw Carol drive away in her car. Michael could not remember anything about putting tape on a dresser drawer, which is what he had said before, but he did remember using other detection devices involving baby powder and putting paper on a door. The state felt as though the inconsistent nature of Michael's story was enough to convict him of murder. On April 13, 2011, Michael was arrested and charged with second-degree murder. The state offered Michael a chance to plead guilty to voluntary manslaughter, but he turned down the offer. His trial started in October 2012. Ultimately, Michael was found guilty. Before he was sentenced, he confessed to killing Carol, even though he had no agreement with the state. In January 2013, Michael was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison. In November 2021, at the request of the state, Michael's conviction was reduced from second-degree murder to voluntary manslaughter. He received a sentence of 6 years, which was the maximum available for that charge in 1981. Michael was immediately released because he had served more than 6 years.
Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus, aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
Bei Action gibt es immer extrem niedrige Preise. Diese Woche Wash-Abspülmittel 750 ml nur 88 Cent. Oder zwei Jack Parker Boxershorts aus nachhaltiger Baumwolle nur 3,68. Angebote, die richtig glücklich machen. Für noch mehr extrem günstige Preise einfach in einer Action-Filiale vorbeischauen oder in der App stöbern. Action, kleine Preise, große Freude.
Now moving to my analysis. Here are my thoughts on a few areas that stood out to me in this case. Item number one. Let's take a look at the confession that Michael offered to the state before his sentencing. Michael said that on March 30, 1981, he argued with his wife and she left the house. At 1:30 a.m., now on March 31, she returned. At this time, Carol told Michael that she was taking another man to her sister's wedding. Michael took this to mean that Carol was leaving him and became upset. Carol tried to comfort him by telling him that he would find someone else. Upon hearing this, Michael pushed Carol away, which caused her to fall and slam her head into a table. She died immediately. Michael later changed that part of the story and said he punched Carol one time hard, as opposed to pushing her. After realizing that she was dead, Michael panicked, mostly because of the murder part. He dropped Carol's car off at the Red Onion restaurant and disposed of her body in the ocean. Later, Michael said that he buried her body on land. So once again, there was a change to the story. It's difficult to know which parts of the story to believe and which parts to reject, but it seems clear that Michael was responsible for his wife's death. This brings me to item number two. When Michael was charged with murder, he had not yet confessed to the crime. There were a lot of reasons to believe he would be found not guilty. For example, there was no physical evidence that he committed a crime, no witnesses, no video. His son told the police that he saw his mother walking quickly and heard the front door slam, and his daughter heard a car start. This supports the idea that Carol left on her own. There was no proof that Carol was actually dead. Considering how she was engaging in infidelity, maybe she ran off with a lover. The only evidence against Michael was the unlikelihood that Carol would abandon her family and how he changed details in his story. I believe there was reasonable doubt in this case. Michael was guilty in reality, but should not have been convicted based on the evidence that was presented to the jury. Item number three, pretty much everyone who knew Michael liked him. The state even conceded that Michael was a good guy. Several of Michael's acquaintances described him as honest, trustworthy, easygoing, nice, mellow, non-confrontational, even-tempered, friendly, kind, patient, giving, and funny. After Carol's disappearance, Michael continued to work with Carol's father, Milton. He even took over the business after Milton retired. Michael regularly spent time with Carol's family members, which included attending holiday parties and other family events. They considered him to be a member of their family. Even when he was on trial for Carol's murder, her family did not believe Michael was guilty. Nobody appeared to be angry or upset with Michael. His son said that he didn't want his father to go to prison, even if convicted. Item number four, what do I think happened in this case? This is just a theory, my opinion. Michael was a kind and laid-back individual, whereas Carol was cold, callous, self-centered, grandiose, and had a sense of entitlement. They had different feelings about their marriage. Michael was content, but Carol felt as though she had outgrown their relationship. She was having at least one affair and was ready to move on. Carol was looking for someone more mature who could provide her with the finer things in life, like a multi-bathroom residence. On the night of March 30, 1981, Carol pressured Michael to sign a document to list the house for sale. This was her first step to end the relationship. When he wouldn't budge, she returned to the house and tried to make Michael angry by revealing that she was having an affair. Michael's initial reaction was to have feelings of sadness. Carol's lack of empathy expressed itself clearly when she approached Michael and said he would find someone else. Carol had no idea how devastating that statement is to someone who has just been rejected by a spouse. She did not have the ability to understand how Michael felt. In a moment of rage, Michael attacked and killed Carol, but did not intend to cause her death. He managed to dispose of her body without being detected, but unwisely made statements to many people, including the police and the media. If he had simply remained silent, he never would have been arrested. There is the sense that Michael believed it was his destiny to be arrested. At one point, he hinted to the police about cooperating with them as if he intended to confess. I think Michael was trying to reconcile his generally pro-social nature with his awful crime. He really wanted to tell somebody what he did, but he was not interested in going to prison. Now moving to my final thoughts. As I mentioned, many people empathized with Michael and felt sorry for him. It's rare to hear someone speak of a killer so generously. I can imagine his supporters saying something like, "Well, Michael may have killed someone, but did I mention how he's a nice guy? Like, really nice. In fact, he's so easy to get along with, let's not even worry about the homicide." Despite the level of compassion displayed toward Michael, I think it's important to remember that Carol never had a chance to offer her side of the story. She never had the opportunity to explain why she was frustrated in her marriage, why she had an affair, why she confronted Michael. It's also possible that Michael did actually plan to kill her, but again, without Carol's side of the story, there's no way to know what happened. Even though Michael was an affable guy, he killed someone without justification and repeatedly lied about it. A person can be likable and be a killer at the same time.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.